to protect America from transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, the United States Department of Agriculture ordered Larry and Linda's prized milking sheep slaughtered. This leads us to ask, what did Larry and Linda's milk sheep have to do with mad cows?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuning to the 511th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Rick Gaucher on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day to you, Michael.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
And holy smokes, look who we have here. Captain Hungry's down from Montana. Say hello, Dad.
Hello, folks.
And his wife, Delphine, say hello.
The same. Hi.
Okay, good. Folks, encephalopathies are diseases of the brain in which a rogue protein called a prion turns the brain into, well, sponge. And thus the term spongiform encephalopathy. In cattle, it's called mad cow disease. In deer and elk, chronic wasting disease. In sheep, it's called scrapies. And in people, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Once that rogue protein takes over the brain, it's curtains for the victim, as there simply is no antidote to the rogue protein. The brain simply wastes away into pure madness. Though the encephalopathies have been around forever without causing us much concern, We are coming to the realization that the diseases could be transmissible. This leads us to ask, who will protect us from this transmissible madness? Here to help us explore this question, we have a couple of folks, good folks from Vermont, Linda and Larry Falais. Linda and Larry, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having us on, Michael.
Good.
Hi, Michael.
Good. Good to hear you. Gosh, sheep farmers from Vermont, how rustic and beautiful and quaint. How did you become sheep farmers? This is a fascinating story because it began in England.
Yeah, Larry had gotten, he has a PhD in animal science and was offered a postdoc at the University of Nottingham over in England. And so we went over to England for 3 years to study. He was actually looking at mice on pigs, who are very prolific, and I ended up working with a professor and studying mad cow disease, of all things.
So, and of course, this is when mad cow disease was relatively unknown. We're just experiencing it, an epidemic of it in England, right?
Yeah, it was almost at the midway point, because it was from 1990 to 1993, and mad cow disease was discovered in 1985. Mm-hmm. So it was to the point that the government was very involved in trying to figure out what the causes were and how to deal with the outbreak of mad cow disease in Britain.
And you really became kind of an expert, a secondary expert on this, because you're working with one of the country's leading experts, right?
Right, and his job was to advise the EU and the British governments on how to deal with mad cow disease. Was there a concern of contaminated feed? How could you deal with scrapie in sheep? How could you deal with BSE in cattle? What were the precautions that needed to be taken? And to stay totally up to date on the latest research. And so it was something that, you know, was our every evening conversation when Larry and I would go home.
And how is it that you came to be sheep farmers in Vermont from, you know, working in England?
Have you ever heard of that book, What Color's Your Parachute?
No, I've heard of the book, but I haven't read it. But
right. It's a book that basically helps you decide where you really should be going in life and giving you ideas for careers. And my sister gave us a copy of that. And Larry and I knew that we wanted to work together. We wanted to do something in agriculture and have something the family would be involved. It would be financially viable.
So you went about reinventing an industry that had disappeared in the United States, correct?
It had never really existed in the United States. And that's one of the ironies, is that when our ancestors came over, they all brought meat and wool breeds, but they didn't bring the dairy breeds of sheep.
Now, I've been asking around and asking my friends and asking producer Carol Stafford, who knows everything about everything, about milk sheep. And everybody looks at me and says, what? I've heard of milk goats. I've heard of milk cows. But I've never heard of milk sheep. Where did milk sheep come from? Is there a tradition someplace that I'm missing?
There's a long tradition. Sheep have actually been milked for 2,000 years longer than cattle. And there's more sheep in the world that are milked than cows. But the reaction that you got was the same reaction that I gave Larry when he came across the British Sheep Dairy News letter and said, I want to milk sheep. I think we should milk sheep. You know, I looked at him and said, you're nuts. We're going to milk what? But when we came to Vermont and started doing the research into agriculture, you know, enterprises, he came across the import figures, which showed that at that point...
48 million pounds of sheep milk cheeses were being imported in the early 90s per year.
So there's opportunity, right? We're importing 48 million pounds of sheep milk cheese, and we have no milking sheep.
Yeah, exactly. No milking sheep, and there was a few people kind of trying out milking meat and wool breeds just to see if it would work, and so there was a very, very small amount of cheese being produced at that time, you know, virtually none, though.
So we talk about milking sheep breeds. So there must be a breed of sheep that you milk and a breed of sheep that you grow for meat and a breed of sheep that you grow for wool, correct?
Right, and it's the same as with cattle. In fact, the dairy breed of sheep comes from the same region the Holstein Friesians come from. It's the East Friesian sheep, and they come from the Friesian Islands in the north of the Netherlands and northern Germany.
Do they have big old udders like cows, like dairy cows? They do.
Yep.
I've never seen one. Interesting. Okay, so you tracked down these breeds then, right? And brought them, imported them into the United States. So that was a relatively simple process, right? You throw them on an airplane and bring them over?
Well, it took 3 years. And the first thing we did was we called up USDA. And we said, okay, we're interested in finding out how to bring over the genetics to have a dairy sheep industry. And so they recommended that we call all the different embassies and find out who has, you know, which country has dairy breeds of sheep. And then once we narrowed the countries down, then we had to go actually look at the animals and then find out, could we bring in semen, embryos, or live animals? And we ended up having a meeting at the Belgian Ministry of Agriculture in Brussels, and the USDA, Mark Doolin, that was working there, suggested that we bring in live animals, mm-hmm. which was amazing.
And then to make a long story short, because we have to take a break here in just a few minutes, you did bring in these sheep.
Yep.
Okay. Folks, this is not the first sheep show that I have done. I have done a show on sheep several years ago, and the show was about sheep that were being raised for wool up in the Montana mountains. And we did the show from the kitchen table of a sheep farmer up there, right outside of Yellowstone Park. And while we were doing the show, because the government was reintroducing wolves in Yellowstone Park, and those wolves were eating this sheep rancher's sheep. And so we were sitting there at the kitchen table doing a live program, talking with him. And during the course of that program, in walked the government biologist responsible for reintroducing sheep, and he had a big tracking antenna in his hand, and he said, look here, she's back, referring to, of course, the wolf that was coming back out of Yellowstone Park to eat the sheep rancher's sheep. And so I asked the government biologist why he was reintroducing wolves into the environment, and I said, was it to control the deer and to control the elk? And he said, no. We're doing this to... because city people want us to do this. And when I ran across the story of Linda and Larry Falais it had the same kind of ring to the story, and so we're bringing him on. And when we come back from this break, we're going to ask Linda and Larry if they had a government official show up at their farm and what happened when they did. Folks, this is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we're talking with Linda and Larry Falais, who are with Ag Innovations and Three Shepherds Farm in rural Vermont. And Linda's also the author of Mad Sheep. And when we come back from this break, we're going to figure out what happened when the government met the Falaises in Vermont. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Please do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Spongiform encephalopathy. In cattle, it's called mad cow disease. In deer and elk, chronic wasting disease. In sheep, it's called scrapies. And in people, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. Once the rogue protein that takes over the brain, its curtains for the victims, is there simply no antidote to rogue proteins. And the brain simply wastes away into pure madness. And though these encephalopathies have been around for a long time, we're becoming increasingly aware of them and perhaps frightened of them because we're beginning to believe they're transmissible. And so we're asking, who's going to protect us from these transmissible encephalopathies? We've got Larry and Linda Falais of, what's the name of your farm? Three shepherds. Three shepherds. Who are the three shepherds?
Three children.
three children. So when you brought these sheep over, you were very cognizant of the encephalopathies, right?
Very much, because the professor that I worked with over in England, he established the first scrapie surveillance program, and that's a program where a shepherd would enroll his flock, the flock would get tagged, the government would come once a year and inspect the animals. In Europe, they actually take one animal a year and they make sure that they kill it and test it to see if there's any signs of the disease. And if you have 5 years go by and there's no sign of the disease, then the flock is deemed free of scrapie, because scrapie is also a genetic disease, and more than 85% of it is found in particular breeds of sheep, such as the Suffolk.
Okay, let's get down to that then. With respect to are the encephalopathies transmissible?
Yes, they are.
They are
within breeds.
Within breeds,
right? So what they have not proven is that it crosses the species barrier to go to other breeds. That was the theory with the BSE or mad cow disease, that somehow it had jumped the species barrier and was infecting humans. Mm-hmm. But that link has still not been proven.
And in humans, it's called Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Yeah, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Well, here in the neighborhood, the friends of our radio station here have come across a fellow who is suffering from Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. And it's probably one of the cruelest things we've ever seen. It's like Alzheimer's disease times 100.
It's horrible, and it's been around since the early 1900s, and it was actually discovered by two German researchers, Creutzfeldt and Jakob, and so it occurs one in a million, and it's like a spontaneous form, and people don't know why, but it just appears in one in a million people in the population. And so the United States generally has 200 and some cases a year.
Mm-hmm. Well, Linda, are we certain as to what's causing the encephalopathies? Are we certain why it's being transmitted?
Nope. No, there's so many unknowns with this disease. You know, what is the cause of it? Is the prion, I often will say prion just because I haven't studied over in Britain. So, but the prion and prion are the same. And is that an actual cause of the disease? Is it an artifact of the disease, an indicator? People are not sure.
Oh, we don't even know that for sure.
Right.
Have you ever heard of Mark Purdy?
Yes, I have. I've met him. He stayed at our farm before.
Mm-hmm. So we've worked with Mark on the food chain here, too. And he has an entirely different theory than the rest of the world, right?
Which actually makes a lot of sense, because one of the things is that if you look at the cases of mad cow disease, Britain had 180,000 cases, and the rest of the world has had less than 10%. So obviously something was happening in Britain which would exacerbate the problem. And Mark Purdy's theory was that the government had forced the use of organophosphates on animals and that that had caused or contributed to mad cow disease.
So pesticides.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Because the role of the prion is to bind to copper, and in the absence of copper, it will bind to manganese. And the organophosphates are very high in manganese.
And, of course, Purdy's theory is that if you look around the world, you see clusters of the encephalopathies. For example, a chronic wasting disease in the cervid population of Colorado, you'll see a lot of a cluster there. And if you look at the clusters, what you find is a manganese deficiency, right?
Right. Or copper.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. So you're very cognizant of the situation before you went and got into the sheep business. So you're really tuned in. You're tuned into the fact that there are such things as encephalopathy-free flocks.
Right.
And you, of course, drew from those flocks and were certified as being scrapie free when you brought your sheep to the United States, right?
Right. So the breed that we brought over, the East Frisian, has never had a case of scrapie for 200 years.
Wow.
So it's a species or a breed that doesn't have the disease.
And your particular sheep were really closely monitored by the government, too.
Right. When we brought the animals in, it was a requirement of the import protocol that they be part of the United States Scrapie Surveillance Program. So this is a national program that's administered by each individual state. No other flock in Vermont had joined, and so we got the program started in Vermont.
And, of course, all the animals that came in from Europe had already been enrolled for quite a number of years. So they had been observed both in Europe and in the United States. So there was a high degree of certainty that they were free of this disease.
Okay, so tell us about your visit from the government.
Very similar to what you were talking about with visiting with the shepherd and having the wolf come in. We had
it did ring true, didn't it?
The USDA showed up at our farm, and in this instance, it was a woman, Dr. Linda Detweiler, and she said she was concerned that our animals could have been exposed to contaminated feed and be susceptible to mad cow disease.
Mm-hmm.
And we said one of the programs that the professor was in charge in that I was working with over in England was the Feeding Stuffs Committee. And so I was very aware of the theory of meat and bone meal possibly causing mad cow disease.
And we should do a little parenthetical here and tell the audience that this is the prime suspect in the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. Is that
I would call it the leading government theory.
Leading government theory. Okay,
yeah.
Very well put. Is that animals eating animals leads to the encephalopathies, right?
Which, of course, is a bad idea anyway, but
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and Linda Detweiler, with whom we worked here on the food chain, on exactly this subject, came to you and said, your animals, we suspect, have been eating animals and are therefore suspect of having what?
Suspect of having mad cow disease.
How can a sheep have mad cow disease, though?
Exactly. And there was another thing, is that we had all the feed records from the farms that we imported animals from because we wanted to make sure that there was no meat and bone meal fed at all. And most of the farms that we imported from were organic farms and certified organic. And so when Detweiler you know, raise this concern. We said, well, we understand you being concerned, but here's all the feed records, and there's nothing wrong with our sheep.
So you've been keeping records on feeding, you've been keeping records on breeding, you've been keeping records on the sheep themselves. You've had records going back 200 years demonstrating that this breed has never had scrapies, right?
Right.
Yeah. One of the big ironies was the fact that the USDA was the one that came up with the import protocol, and the protocol said nothing about feed. Which was really, when you look at historically at that time in 1996, you know, if that was the leading government theory, why did they not say that the animals should not be fed meat and bone meal? Well, we knew, having worked with it, that that was very important. So we went above and beyond the USDA's own rules when we did the importation.
Okay, here you have a situation where she was kind of like the lead police person for the USDA on mad cow, right?
Yeah, she was given an impossible task. Her responsibility was to keep mad cow disease out of the United States.
And you're suspect number one for bringing it in, even though you don't you're not bringing in cows at all. You're bringing in sheep, right?
Exactly.
Okay, we're going to find out what happened when we come back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour. Today we're talking mad sheep and transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. And who on earth is going to protect us from transmissible madness? We've got Larry and Linda Felice, who are the authors, I guess. Or maybe Linda was the author, but I bet Larry had something to do with it, of the book Mad Cow or Mad Sheep. Please do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, hello out there. We're talking the madness diseases, transmissible spongiform encephalopathies, called mad cow in the cow population, in deer and elk, chronic wasting disease, and sheep, scrapies, and in people, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease. Question is, who's going to protect us from the transmissible madness? Can the government do it? What do you think? Curious to hear what you have to say. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We've got Larry and Linda Felice, who are family farmers in Vermont, author of the book Mad Sheep, published by Chelsea Green. And you, what do you think about this crazy disease? We've got a caller, so we may as well go to her right away and see what she has to say. We've got Kathy on the line. Kathy, are you there? Let's see if I can grab this. I guess I can't. We'll go back to Linda. Linda, you were talking about Linda Detweiler, who had the awesome responsibility of keeping the encephalopathies out of the United States. How do you do that when you don't even know what the heck it is?
Exactly. And so the first thing that Detweiler did was she tried to go around and round up all the cattle that had been directly imported from Europe. And the next thing she did was go after the sheep that were directly imported, so therefore it was the animals we brought over. So
and of course this was a very short-sighted approach, to the fact that since the government's own theory that it was caused by meat and bone meal, and there was tons of this stuff being fed to cattle in the United States, that, you know, she was kind of ignoring the most obvious route of, you know, their own theory and going after our sheep, which don't even get the disease.
So as I understand it from reading Mad Sheep, what the government of Great Britain did was that it banned feeding animals to animals.
Exactly.
And what the rendering companies did in Great Britain was package up this animal feed and send it to the United States and Canada.
Right, because at the time, meat and bone meal was not banned. So, for example, in 1997, there were 87 tons of meat and bone meal, which was imported from Britain directly into the United States.
Mm-hmm. So her method of, do you think she was doing this out of kind of like a naivete? I guess, wish we could have asked her these questions when she was on the program, but why did she go after your sheep?
More desperation, I would think. Wanting to be seen as being very proactive and wanting to be seen as, you know, I'm doing my job, and to make a name for herself. And also, she sat on as a guest on a European committee which studied TSEs, and there was preliminary research coming out where they were looking at sheep that had scrapie, doing these tests to find out if scrapie was actually BSE. And the preliminary results were showing that, yes, sheep had BSE. And eventually, when the study was going to be released, an independent audit of the laboratory found out that the scientists for 7 years had been looking at cow brains, not sheep brains. The brains had been somehow mixed in the freezer.
Minor foul up, right?
Yeah, minor
right.
foul up. And also there was the political issue that you have to understand that in the United States, the cattle industry is very powerful, has a very strong lobby in Washington, where the sheep industry has virtually no lobbyist or protection of any type. It's a very small industry. So I think
are you trying to tell us that there's a relationship between industry and government?
Perhaps.
And of course, there's tremendous pressure on the government to do something to manage the situation, because what did happen, of course, is that bovine spongiform encephalopathy showed up in the cattle herd of the United States from Canada, but it was enough to shut down exports to Japan, one of our biggest customers, right?
Right.
So there was good reason for everybody to be concerned. So what Linda Detweiler from USDA did was, the easiest thing was to pick on sheep people, right?
Right. And this was before the outbreak of BSE in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so here she thought she was going to, you know, be able to come in, take the animals, get rid of them, and, you know, that everything was going to go very quietly. She had no idea of our background or our stubbornness.
Or our sheep's background, for that matter.
Exactly.
So you were, instead of going sheep-like, you were more like jackasses. You dug in your heels and lowered your butt and weren't going to move an inch, right?
Right. And the thing is, you know, they kept saying, oh, well, we'll pay you fair market value. And we kept saying, it doesn't matter what you pay us. There's nothing wrong with our animals, and we're not going to sell out just for money. We chose a lifestyle.
Yeah. What did she want to do?
She wanted to destroy the animals.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is that the USDA didn't have regulations or laws to back them up in trying to do that.
So she looked at these sheep that had been imported from Great Britain.
They were from Belgium and the Netherlands.
From Belgium, okay. Did she look at any of the evidence that you brought?
No. We actually brought over 3 European experts to meet in Washington with the USDA, the National Institute of Health, Senator Leahy's office. It was this large meeting. The Europeans presented all this information, said this is the studies that have been going on of BSE in Europe. This is the background of the flocks of the animals we brought over. And when we opened up for questions, it was silent. And finally, Alfonso Torres, who was Linda Detweiler's boss, said, look, I'm really sorry, but we're under political pressure, and you're going to have to surrender your animals. So they don't even try to hide the fact that they're being controlled by the very industries they're supposed to control.
Let's go to the phone right now. We've got Kathy calling in from a cell phone from Alberta. Kathy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, hi. I've been trying to listen on the computer, and it's failure, so I'm coming in to just listening on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking earlier about manganese and copper, I guess.
Right.
I've been following the research on this BSE, CWD, neurological disorders like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and also the effects of depleted uranium and Gulf War syndrome. And there's an absolute definite connection between the exposure via inhalation of fine particulate, and this particulate that we're breathing in is going through our body, through our bloodstream, through other olfactory bulbs to the brain. And I just was amazed yesterday when I researched a little bit about Linda and Larry. She mentioned, Linda, that you worked for Dr. Lamming.
Yes, Professor Lamming.
Yeah, is it the same George E. Lamming?
Yes, it is.
Eric? Okay, he's done a hell of a lot of research on hormonal stuff that I could find.
Yes.
Nothing I've seen on the abstract documents showed anything about prions per se, so I wonder if that work was all kept under the committee work.
It would have been. He was on the feeding stuff committee. And he was on the EU committee that was making
scientific veterinary committee. His actual area of research was with ruminants and maternal recognition of pregnancy. But his, because he was a longtime expert in the animal sciences, He was, you know, did a lot of this committee work and was considered an expert in that area.
Kathy, we have to take a quick break. You want to hold on?
I will, yeah.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Linda and Larry Falaise about transmissible spongiform encephalopathies and how the madness disease came and took away their sheep. And I guess it was madness of sorts. We're curious to know what you think is going to protect us from the transmissible spongiform encephalopathies. Is it going to be you or I, or is it going to be the government that doesn't seem to really know what this disease, what causes this disease, or where it comes from? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, what do you think, folks? Transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. Encephalopathy simply means brain disease.
Max, don't talk.
Spongiform. Did you say something, Linda?
That was me, probably.
Okay.
I'm at the Burlington Book Festival, so there's a little bit of noise in the background.
Oh, good. Well, let it rip. Folks, we've got Linda and Larry Falaise from the Vermont family farm called The Three Shepherds, and Linda's also the author of Mad Sheep. We've got Kathy is on a cell phone cruising along with us up in Alberta, and Linda and Larry are in Vermont, and I'm in California, so we've got things pretty well triangulated here today. So I kind of go through the term transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. Encephalopathy simply means brain disease.
Encephalopathy means the swelling.
Swelling.
Swelling of the tissue.
Swelling of the tissue. Spongiform means what?
That's where you have the, when you look at the brain under the microscope, it appears to have holes.
Yeah, so it's the spongiosis.
Spongiosis.
Yeah.
And transmissible means?
Able to be spread.
Able to be spread. And that's what we fear most. And when Linda Detweiler from USDA came to your farm, and in spite of the fact that you had all of this documentation, this history going back 200 years, the documentation, the knowledge, everything, the USDA dug in its heels and said, your sheep must go.
Exactly. All of our arguments fell on deaf ears.
It didn't matter what you had to say, did it?
No, it didn't. And so they showed up on March 23rd, 2001, in the middle of a snowstorm with 27 armed federal agents and 13 USDA officials and cleared out our barn of every sheep that we had, the sheep we brought over from Belgium and the Netherlands, the lambs, and the animals, the sheep that we brought from New Zealand.
And these were not just sheep, for those people who are just joining in. These were milk sheep, especially bred milk sheep that went through an incredible process selecting these specific sheep to bring across from Belgium to the United States.
Right, because an average American sheep will produce about 100 pounds of milk in a lactation or in a year,
mm-hmm.
and the animals we imported averaged 1,000 pounds. And some went up over 2,500 pounds in a year.
Wow.
So it was like bringing in the Holstein breed of sheep.
Right. So, and you're looking to start essentially an entirely new industry of sheep cheese here in the United States, because we're importing it but not producing it here. So there's the opportunity to start a whole new industry.
Yeah.
So the USDA said, no, you imported these sheep from Europe. Europe is dangerous. Your sheep must go. And they went. And did the government pay you or anything for them?
Well, they waited 18 months before they sent us a check. And when we brought the animals over, it cost us $5,000 a head, because they had to go through 2 months of quarantine in Europe. They had to go through a month quarantine in the United States. Quarantine is about $28 a night per animal. They had to be flown over. There was a series of blood tests, which was repeated. It was an elaborate process. And then when the animals were getting, once they got over here, the offspring were selling between $5,000 and $7,500. So anyone that voluntarily surrendered to the USDA received what they had paid plus the 40% premium. And when USDA gave us a check, it was $1,300 per animal. And when we said, why the discrepancy between what you paid other people who had these sheep, they said, well, you chose to fight.
And the other people were people that we had. There was two farms involved, ourselves and another farm about an hour from us and we were selling rams to other farms that wanted to get these genetics into their flocks.
Mm-hmm.
So those people gave up their rams because they were able to not only get what they had paid for them, but they had used them in most cases for two breeding seasons. So they had literally hundreds of lambs on the ground that were fathered by these rams. So for them, it was a good deal. But for us, of course, it was our entire flock. So they took everything.
Mm.
Yeah. And the other thing the USDA did is after they gave us this check and, you know, we said, you know, why this small amount compared to everybody, they said, well, if you want any more money, you'll have to go to U.S. Claims Court.
Kathy, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Does this all of this make you feel safer?
Well, I'm on a ranch. I've been doing the research now for 3 years. I'm not scared of eating any meats and developing any form of neurological disease because I am firmly under the belief that the diseases are being caused by metal toxicity. The copper is replaced on the prion protein by other metals. And when I bring this up to people, there's one smart gentleman I talked to. He had quite a good understanding on different toxicology things. I said to him, well, what is the transmissible part of transmissible, encephalopathies? It's a radioactive isotope that accidentally gets attached to the prion. He said, well, that might explain the transmissibility part of it. And the research that's coming out right now is it's coming fast and furious, and they're starting to stay away from calling it infectious because, of course, the prion can never be infectious.
It's not alive, right?
It's not alive. It has DNA makes a protein. Proteins do not have DNA. So the thing that you have to understand is they're changing this now. It's still bloody slow, but they're changing it from an infectious organism to what they're calling a unconventional transmissible agent.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and the agent is not this protein complex. It is the thing that causes the problem is what's attached to it. And lots of doctors now are showing, they're all coming around to the way of thinking of Mark Purdy and Dr. David Brown from the University of Bath in the UK. These guys have known this stuff for the last 20 years almost and trying to get it out there. And all of a sudden, everybody's jumping on their bandwagon.
They're starting to listen. Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're going to take a quick break. Come back with a conclusion with the Felices and Kathy up in Alberta and you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. So the question is, who will protect us from transmissible spongiform encephalopathies? Because it is the cruelest of diseases in humans called Creutzfeldt-Jakob. And if it is transmissible, how is it transmissible? And how do we stop it? Kathy up there in Alberta, what do we do to stop it? If it's not animals eating animals...
Well, that's part of it, because when they eat the bone meal, they're getting the concentrated heavy metals in the bone. But it's not a prion that's carrying it. You know, this magic protein doesn't transfer that metal from the gut to the brain. It's other proteins that are metalloproteins, or even just the straight metals get in our blood.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you the name. A doctor, Amir Hamir, H-A-M-I-R, has done studies in the 80s on lead toxicity with dogs where they exposed them to lead inhalation. The same way as some of the DU stuff is being inhaled. And he found that the dogs that they developed spongiform encephalopathy symptoms, like the holes in the brain, very similar to TSEs, just with lead exposure through this inhalation of fine particulate.
You're telling us is that it's just bad stuff in the air.
It's that's part of it. There's the food component of it is the fact that animals, the recycling of the bones, really, really concentrated these heavy metals and different metals like manganese into our system. And obviously, foods when you eat foods that are concentrated in certain metals, I mean, some metals are very important to our bodies, like selenium and zinc and copper. But in Alberta, just an example, they did a study on the emissions of oil and gas. It's called WISSI, W-I-S-S-I,
mm-hmm.
and the effects on cattle. And the technical summary gave some very informative information. You've got to know how to read these papers to pick out their indiscrepancies. But one of the most important things we found in that was that of the feed samples, the forage samples that were tested for their minerals and that and protein levels, in Alberta and Saskatchewan. 501 forage samples were tested, and 93% of those samples were deficient in zinc.
We're looking at mineral and metal deficiencies
imbalances. The 93 and 90% deficiency in zinc and copper were the big ones, and then 65 phosphorus, 60% selenium. And this is based on the requirements of a lactating cow.
Well, Linda and Larry Felice, is anybody looking toward the government for, does the government have a handle on this, or is this... is this a wild theory put forth by Mark Purdy and being propagated around the world? What do you think?
I definitely agree with what Kathy's saying. And I think one of the things that the government fears is their involvement in it, the fact that the British government mandated the use of organophosphate. So if they subscribe to Mark Purdy's theory, they therefore have to be held accountable. And so it's much easier to say, oh, well, it must have been the meat and bone meal, if you can, you know, blame another industry for it.
And of course, the chemical industries have a lot of control over the government as well. So.
Can I bring up, hello?
Well, you can, but you can't right now. You have to do it on the forum page at metrofarm.com. Folks,
I'd like to leave my number with Linda and Larry if I get a chance.
Okay, I'll put you on hold here and take care of it that way. I want to thank Linda and Larry Felice for joining us today. What about it out there? Is the USDA protecting us from the encephalopathies? Log on your thoughts on the forum page at metrofarm.com. We got a brand new forum page there. The best answer will win a copy of Mad Sheep from Linda Felice. I want to thank you all for tuning in. Hope to see you next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. Remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.